Jesus and the Great Pyramid.
There are a few things we'd like to say in preparation for our remarks. I'm making a few premises. Hope I'm correct. I'm working on the premise that all of you have read the chapter in the third volume on the Great Pyramid. So we're not going to spend a lot of time on the basics of the pyramid. We're going to go in a little beyond with that assumption that's there. We'll cover very briefly the passageway system. But other than that, we're going to make that assumption. The pyramid is a monument that most Bible students feel does have biblical backing from Isaiah 19:19-21. It's a monument, however, as we go into it, the details are conjectural. We do deduce. We think our deductions are correct, but they are deductions. Like any type, the pyramid also cannot be used to prove any doctrine. It is only there to illustrate things that are already proven more clearly in other parts of the Word of God. But it does give us a beautiful illustration of how God deals with mankind. So we'll look at the pyramid as a whole in the passage system, and we will notice certain things in just covering the plan very briefly in the chart, so I can see this better. We start with the descending passageway because mankind enters on the road to sin and death. There are only two ways to get upward. Unfortunately, the first way, the ascending passage, representing the law of the Old Testament, is blocked off. There is no opportunity. Man could not keep that law because of imperfection. There is another way through here, bringing you to a point where all of a sudden a narrow passage becomes an immensely high passage, where the ascending passage becomes a grand gallery, and this shows the death of Christ at that place, making open both life on the human plane in the Queen's Chamber and immortality on the spiritual plane in the King's Chamber. That's basically all there's to the pyramid. That's the whole plan of the pyramid. I've covered 1 minute of time, and we're done. So now we're going to look at some other details. Now, in the structure, you find many rooms. You find many passageways. You find air chambers. One room, stands out above all other rooms. Architecturally, and I want to stress the word architecturally, as the most important room in the building. What room would you think it to be? King's Chamber, of course. And of course that's wrong. but that's the answer all of us would give. But there is another room in this building that is so important, the whole pyramid had to be planned around it. This room was there before the pyramid was there. This room is this little grotto. The grotto is in many ways the most important room because if all the passages were designed, as we presume they are, then this passage going through the grotto, you move the pyramid 10 feet to the right and you're not going to go through the grotto. You move it 10 feet backward, you're not going to go through the grotto. You have to start here. That's got to be the architect's starting point in planning. He has to know where that is going to fit so the whole building can fit around it. It is the foundation room of the pyramid. That grotto represents Jesus. Jesus as the ransom sacrifice. The entire plan of God is built around that. Everything is centered upon it. It is the foundation. In our next transparency, we want to look at the location of that grotto a little more specifically. The same picture, but now we've drawn a red line through here. The black shaded line is the natural earth surface. They had to do some building up over some of the lower parts. So the grotto is part of the natural earth surface, but it is at the highest point of the earth surface. Very fitting for the text where it says, a body hast thou prepared me. Jehovah prepared a body for Christ, perfect human body of the human nature of the earth, but at the very highest point of the earth. Notice also this granite plug. The granite plug showed the perfection of the law of God. There's only two places in the pyramid where granite is currently used. And I state that because of the third place where it may have been intended to be used. But there's two where it was currently used and only two we can point to. One is in the granite plug and the other will come to later. It's in the king's chamber in this little coffer. It's in the king's chamber. Those are the only two. There were some granite chips that were found down here, but there is no other granite piece in the pyramid other than these two places. Granite in the pyramid, like gold in the tabernacle, represents holiness, spirituality, God, God's divine requirements, God's will. It can represent divine nature as well. Here we think it represents the divine requirements of the law, the requirements of a perfect human man. And you notice the grotto is exactly on a level with the granite plug. He comes across and he fulfills that law. That is how we know that Christ was perfect. Only a perfect man could keep a perfect law. And because Jesus kept that perfect law, we see him here in the grotto. Those who have been in the grotto, and some here, I think Jordan has been there, those who have been in the grotto and have noticed that there is a unique stone in this grotto, and I'm going to mention the stone in passing, but I'm not going to put much confidence in the stone. It's called the Lamb's Head Stone. It's a stone that has a unique resemblance to a lamb's head. But you know how stones are. You can look at a stone and your imagination can run wild. You can see various things in various stones. But if it is, it's very appropriate. It is an appropriate place because truly, in the grotto is the first place we see Christ in the pyramid. Having covered this, we want to look at another place we see him, not in the pyramid, but indicated by the pyramid. We'll go to our next transparency. Upside down. And we have a map of the area covering from Egypt all the way to Israel. Pyramid is right here. And if you take the pyramid passage angle, where all the passages are the same angle, and you extend that angle, an angle of 26 degrees, 18 minutes and 10 seconds, you extend that, you come directly through the town of Bethlehem. Now, it's interesting to note that Jesus, when he was born, you recall, because of the animosity of Herod, fled to Egypt. And when that is recorded in the Bible in the Gospel of Matthew, we read in Matthew 2:15 that Jesus was there till the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." We have that exact angle of the pyramid showing, "Out of Egypt have I called my son." The quotation in Matthew 2 is taken from Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. "When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt." Notice the difference? Matthew says Jesus was called out of Egypt to fulfill this prophecy. But the prophecy said Israel was called out of Egypt. And Israel was, under Moses, in the time of the Exodus. And it's obvious as you read Hosea 11, it's the Exodus that he's referring to. It's the Exodus prophecy. Let's take our same pyramid angle that applied to Jesus and Matthew and apply it to Israel and see how it shows both connecting the two links of the prophecy. If you recall, in the history of Israel in the Exodus, there were two main barriers that they had to cross. And they crossed both of these barriers 40 years apart by the same method. They crossed them by God drying up the waters so they could go dry shod. Initially, it was the coming out of Egypt. Pharaoh's armies chasing them down to the Red Sea, the Reed Sea. And there, no way to go. They couldn't go backwards. Pharaoh's armies were there. They were encaged by mountains on the north and the south. The only way to go was, as Moses said, go forward. And they stepped on the waters of the sea, and it divided, and they were carried through. Now, we don't have a precise location for this in the Bible, but we have a good indication. Exodus 14 says the last stop was at Baal Zephon, and then they crossed the Red Sea. And Baal Zephon is located right there. That same line crosses the Red Sea at the same place when he called Israel out of the land. 40 years later, they came to the River Jordan, and they crossed near Jericho. And you send that same line beyond Bethlehem, and you cross the Jordan right at Jericho. So not only does it show the passage of Jesus coming from Bethlehem to Egypt, but the path of Egypt in the type, going across at Baal Zephon and coming back across through the Jordan. This is the second place we see the indication of Christ, type and antitype, in the pyramid of Egypt. In our third area, we're going to be talking about quite a few different ways that Christ is shown. We're going to be noticing a measurement which, to the best of my knowledge, has no meaning. To the best of my knowledge, it has no meaning other than the fact it reappears 6 times. And therefore, it is the reoccurrence of the measurement that has significance to us. Let's go to our next transparency. And we're going to notice a figure called 286.1. Now, before we talk about this figure, I'd like to talk about one other aspect of the pyramid. Any three-dimensional object has at least 2 axes. Axes meaning going from the center down. Here you've got an axis on the east to west side of the pyramid. East-west axis. Axis comes here. And here you've got an axis on the north-south. And the axis comes here. We're going to refer briefly to this axis first and then come back to this slide. So let's look at our next transparency and look at the north-south axis of the Great Pyramid. You'll notice 2 lines are drawn here, a blue line and a red line. And the reason for this is the diagrams that we have noted differ. Both are not right. I have not been able to determine which is right. So I will give the lesson from both because they're very, very similar lessons. The one that Brother Russell uses in the third volume has the axis where the red line comes. And the one that Edgar uses, taken from Smythe, has the axis where the blue line comes. And so there is a slight difference. The point that Brother Russell makes on the axis is an interesting point. He says that which is north of the axis represents those things that are human. And that which is south of the axis represents the spiritual. Both the destiny of the church in the king's chamber and those who do fall into second death. That's the only thing that's found south of the axis. Using the Edgar, it's more like you plant the chart of the ages over this. And you see the beginning of the messianic age coming here, a timeline that is drawn. So in either case, there is a significance to the north-south axis. That is not our point today. We just mentioned that because when I mention axis and I mention center of the pyramid, I'm going to be talking not the center of the pyramid on a north-south basis, but on an east-west basis. So now let's go back to our former transparency. The pyramid, if you ever see pictures of it, you'll notice the entrance is off-center. You do not enter in the middle of the pyramid. That's the logical place. The logical place with a symmetrical structure is to enter center. But instead, the entrance is off-centered by a factor of 286.1 inches. Dave was telling me yesterday that's 12 cubits? 14 cubits. 14 of the royal cubit of Egypt, right? 14 of the royal cubits of Egypt off center. I'm going with pyramid inches. 286.1 pyramid inches. What does that represent that it is not centered? Well, first we'll notice the direction. It's off-centered to the east. I'd like to make a few comments about the direction east in Old Testament history. And to do this, we need to look at a map. So let's go to our next transparency, which is a map. And we're going to go back right to the very first book of the Bible, the Genesis. We want to notice, go a little higher up if you can. That's great. That's fine. In Genesis 2:8, we find at the creation of Adam, the Bible says that the Lord planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man when he had formed. The traditional area for Eden is down here. I'm going to give you other reasons why I think this is more correct area up here. But that'll come a little later in our presentation. Eastward in Eden. Eastward, what does that mean? If I were to say I live in Chicago, and I asked Dave Rice where I live, he'd say, oh, you live way east. But if I were to ask Bob Gray, he'd say, you live west. Eastward is a relative term. It's relative to something. He doesn't say what it's relative to here. Presumably, it's relative to the writer of the account. That writer may have been Moses, it may have been a collection of tablets that were given to Moses, but it was somewhere west of these areas here where it was found, probably over in the area of either Palestine or Mesopotamia. So eastward here has no meaning at all. It's just telling us, from the author's perspective, it's east. But then you recall that not too long after, sin entered the world, and after sin entered, it wasn't too long after, the first murder came. Cain slew his brother Abel. And now we look in Genesis 4, verse 16, and Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Now we have a perspective. He's not saying eastward from where I'm writing. He's saying I'm eastward from where Eden is. And Nod is generally assumed to be in this general area. It was in the desert area of what is today northern Iran, where a lot of the problems with the Kurdistans and the Iraqi are in this general area. So that we notice that when man sinned, God sent him eastward. We're suggesting in the pyramid the same thing. When you got 286 degrees east, you're going into the area of sin. Man does not enter the pyramid in harmony with the top stone. Man enters the pyramid out of harmony. And you say, that's not true. Adam was created perfect. Adam was created in harmony. But the pyramid, as you recall, starts with man on the downward slope. It starts with the fall of man. It's on the downward slope. And while we're at this map, we want to notice one other geographical thing about Eden, because it's an interesting tie-in to the pyramid. Man was given a commission to go out and populate the earth. Didn't go too far. There wasn't too many people yet. Eventually, after the flood, he went even further. But where did he go? Where was this Eden, and where would he go? We have a clue in Genesis. It says four rivers flowed out of Eden. Well, really one river breaking into four branches. Two of the branches are still known rivers. Hiddekel, which is the Tigris, and the Euphrates. We have the Tigris, the Euphrates. Now, as long as I've been alive, water tends to flow downward. And I think that probably was true in all times. So it suggests there were elevations for the water to flow out of. You don't start a river in the lowest spot and go to the highest. You start a river in the highest spot and go to the lowest. And for that reason, I say, here the Tigris and Euphrates are close. Before the flood, they may have been joined. The only other possibility is here. They're close. And they may have joined there. We don't know how the flood changed the topography. That is an unknown factor. But from the known factors we have, this area was not early populated. Man flowed southward. The stream of man originally from the garden And from Ararat, whether you take the Ararat here or the Ararat that's over here, there are two Ararats that are in argument. In either case, the flow was southward, because this is recognized as the cradle of mankind, the Mesopotamian Valley. There was a southward flow. So man goes southward, but he's east of center, he's in sin. That's what the pyramid shows. In the pyramid, you enter descending southward, east of center. 286.1 inches east of center, to be precise. Let's look at our next transparency. As you go through the passages of the pyramid, you eventually come to the king's chamber. Now, because the passages are all in a straight line, you're always 286 inches east. You're never moving that way at all. You're just moving south. You can move south down, you can move south up, depending which way the passage you're on. But you're not moving east or west. The only place you can move east or west is if you get to a large room. And the largest room is the king's chamber. And there you can move, and there's a coffer over here. An empty tomb representing the memorial of the sacrifice of Christ. And it's precisely 286.1 inches east, west. It's back under the center. Now, here's what I want to stress. Not under the center on a east-west basis. Under the center on an east-west basis, not on a north-south basis. We saw the center is different there. But there, the axis line on the east-west basis, sin, perfection. Sin, perfection. Christ represented here that same factor, perfection. We see what is required for man's salvation. A corresponding Christ. A Christ here we can measure in mathematical terms. Let's look at another place where this is found. Let's go to the Grand Gallery. You remember that Grand Gallery was so tall, and the entrance to it was so small. It was less than 4 feet, so you had to really bow. I remember going up it myself, and it was very stressful to go up it. And you can see here how he's stooping to come up it, and then how this beautiful, lofty, tiered structure, you come into a room that is immensely tall. In fact, the difference in height between the first ascending passage and the Grand Gallery height is 286.1 inches. The same factor. Christ brings life and immortality to light. This is the area here, often this little section here where the entrance of the well shaft comes. This looks like an explosion. It exploded that whole passage system. It blew it up. The exact area that man needs to enjoy life. 286.1 inches. But let's look at another aspect where the same figure comes in. And let's go to the next transparency, and let's go to the very apex of the pyramid. Oh, no, we're not. We've got another example of the Grand Gallery, just another drawing showing the height difference, emphasizing the same point we had in our last transparency. So we can go on to the next one. That's the next number? I'm surprised that's the number. Okay. Here we have, oh, that's right, we need to look at this one first. We have here the pyramid as it more or less appears today, without a headstone. Was that headstone ever on the pyramid? I don't know. I'm not that old. But there is some evidence both ways. You take your choice, and you can deduce two things from this evidence. The historian that David referred to yesterday, Herodotus, he mentions the pyramid with the headstone. He says, I saw it with the headstone. There is a question mark as to whether Herodotus was actually there, but he reports with the headstone. The Egyptian historian, Manetho, living 100 years later, records very specifics about the pyramid, and he says, there was not a headstone on it. It was a decapitated structure. Now, either that headstone appeared in the 100 years between Herodotus and Manetho, which does not seem too likely, or it never was there. We do have some scriptural evidence, but the scriptural evidence is weak. But I'll give it anyway. There are two verses that Bible students love to quote about the headstone. Others say, no, this is not the headstone of the pyramid. This is the chief cornerstone of the temple. And I am inclined to agree with them. But regardless, let's take it from the standpoint of those that feel this is the pyramid. They're found in Matthew 21:42, which is a quotation from Psalm 118:22. It says, the top stone of the corner, the stone the builders rejected. Notice the word rejected. It implies that if they had the stone, they said, won't work. Something's wrong. Something may very well have been wrong. We'll come to what may have been wrong. There are various possibilities why it was rejected, if so. When you get to find what the size of that stone is, and you think building the pyramid was marvelous, you're going to be amazed if they ever got a headstone up there. That is one tremendous-sized stone, if it was one stone. But let's take, for now, the fact. We're going to talk more about it, but we'll talk, say now, it wasn't there. And yet, it is the perfect model of the whole. Christ has been the model of the whole. Christ has been rejected. Man has not been able to live up to that model. They have sincere individuals, sincere Christians especially, sincere Jews before, have sought to live to the model of perfection. They've not been able to copy it. It has been a copy that has been without their ability. And we'd like to notice how that may be shown and what it may represent in Christ in the pyramid. But now let's go to the top here without that stone, as it appears today. And look at our next thing and see what the ideal size stone for that top is. The space that is open today, measured from the center in all directions, is 286.1 inches. He is the required top stone. He does match the specifications. Now you've got a tremendous stone, and that's one stone. You're looking at a stone that is roughly 48 feet square, tapered up, much bigger than any other stone in the pyramid. And this is the stone that some say, with little authority, I have to admit, was planned to have been a granite. And that may be only for the beauty of symbology, because there's nothing, no evidence, no hard evidence that the stone was to be granite. Nor is there any hard evidence that the capstone from here was to be one stone and not a group going up to match the one stone concept. But your ideal measurement here, what Christ supplies, is everything that is lacking in man. He is the perfect, the complete, the full offset. When this comes to a practical application, in the kingdom, there's another place this measurement appears. And it's an amazing place. So let's look at our next transparency. I mentioned, I can see right now I'm a little bit ahead of myself, so I'm going to back up here a minute. Why didn't the pyramid meet its specifications? Napoleon, in his journals, records that the pyramid was concave. Brother Adam Rutherford of England developed a thought on this, and he went to the pyramid to research it. And I must admit, on this, there were two definite opposing schools. Brother Adam Rutherford on one side, and Brother Morton Edgar on the other side. Brother Adam Rutherford said, I wonder if that concavity shows that the pyramid was displaced. And so the only way to prove that would be to go to the cornerstones and check the score lines as to where the score lines directed straight across, or they directed a concave angle. He made that trip in 1949. He came back and said, I'm convinced the score lines were square, not at a concave angle. But the pyramid is concave. Brother Edgar went in 1950 to rebut him. He came back. He wrote to Brother W.A. Baker, I found my evidence, and he died. We don't know what the evidence is. So I don't know if he's right or wrong. That evidence died with Brother Edgar's death in 1950. But if Brother Adam Rutherford is correct in 1949, his measurements, then you can determine the concave angle from the few casing stones that are left. If you measure those stones and project those stones across, will they come to the ideal corner line? And the answer is no, they will not. There was a concave angle that's there. That's reality. What was intended, we don't know. Can you move that a little higher? At the very bottom of that. If you take X as the ideal score line, and you measure that around the pyramid, and you take the concave line exceeds the ideal line by 286.1 inches. So it almost indicates that it was intended, that God knew that man needed a correction factor. Okay, now let's go to our next area, not that one, the one after. One other place this measurement is found, when you come down the descending passage, all of a sudden it levels off and goes to the pit. Now the ascending passage is blocked by granite plug. That plug's permanent. You're not going to move that plug. In fact, that plug was not inserted. It was built there. There is no way they could have inserted that plug. It had to be part of the original plan. So they didn't build the plug and then, as some would say, put the king in the chamber and plug the thing. This plug would not permit that. It was done at the same time the coffer was built in the chamber. And the coffer had to be built in the chamber. It's too big for the passages. You can't move a 4-foot piano through a 3-foot door. And you can't move that coffer through the passage system. Man is in the death condition. He needs to be brought up to a life condition. The well shaft pictures various things. It pictures the way through Christ. For the church, it pictures our acceptance, our justification. Then, having that, we walk upwards through our life to the spiritual plane. But the well shaft is also used by mankind. Let's take a term that we all know. The highway of holiness. Isaiah 35, 8 to 10. And it's always going to be easy. It's a highway. We can just get out there and not stop and just keep going forward. It's not going to be easy. The kingdom is not a period of ease. Man comes back from the tomb as man went into the tomb. He's got to overcome throughout that age, the evils and parts of his life. When we pray, thy kingdom come, we're not praying for the millennial kingdom. We're praying for the kingdom, God's kingdom. Ages to come, that which is after. When we speak of a kingdom of peace, we're speaking of a kingdom that will make peace, but not a kingdom that starts with peace. We're speaking of a kingdom that was pictured in the dreams of Pharaoh for 7 years of famine. We're speaking of a kingdom that the Jubilee system predicted. And the Jubilee was a year of losses. It was a year of litigation to get back your land, determine the boundaries. When you're talking about peace, you're talking about the results of the kingdom. And so mankind, in a way, has a narrow way to go. The highway also has narrowness to it. But they can't start that way until something happens. Nobody can enter the highway of holiness who is dead. First, they've got to be brought to life. That's the first step. Once they're brought to life, then they can move upward. And I use my terms carefully. Once they are brought to life, I did not say once they are resurrected. Resurrection is not being brought to life. Resurrection is being brought to perfection of life. To the standing Adam had. It is the full upstanding. But first, before they can get the full upstanding, they need to have the resuscitation in coming out of the grave. That's the first requirement. Man does not earn salvation. Man obtains salvation as a free gift. Man must work to maintain salvation. Obtaining salvation is relatively easy. You don't need to believe in Christ to obtain salvation. You've got to be purchased by Christ to obtain salvation. But you need to not only believe in Christ, but follow Him to maintain salvation. That's what man must do. But they cannot maintain it until they obtain it. 1 Timothy 2:4. God will that all men come to the truth. No. God will that all men be saved, and then come to a knowledge of the truth. That factor of coming from death to resuscitation is here. And that means he has to come out of this plane by 286.1 inches. Christ's death does not give him the Queen's favor. Christ's death gives him the opportunity to come up and walk the way that will eventually make the way into the Queen's chamber, the area of perfect human life. So in the looking so far at this area, we've seen six places this measurement appeared in summer. You enter the pyramid 286 inches off center. Christ in the coffer offsets that exactly, showing his perfection is the other way. We saw the ideal headstone measured in all directions, that measurement of perfection. We saw that the pyramid may have been intentionally or unintentionally offset by that same degree. And we saw that mankind must come to life before they can maintain that through the highway of holiness. Now let's go back to the slide we looked at earlier. This is another place where Christ is shown in the pyramid. We talked about this a little bit in the question meeting. I'm going to talk about it again. We say there was no headstone in the pyramid. And that's correct. At least it's correct today. No, there is no headstone there. And yet, in a very real sense, there is. When I was there, there were three poles. They weren't at the very edges like this. There's four here. There were three put more in the center. And they were put there to show what the exact height of the pyramid would have been. They were not put there by the Egyptians as a tourist attraction. They were put there by the international scientific community as part of celebrating a geophysical year. That geophysical year, when those poles are put there, was, interestingly enough, 1874. From that time on, you see the headstone, but it's invisible. It's there, but it's not there so really you can touch it. But you do have it there. Now, whether that was coincidental, that may have been. It may have been coincidental the air passage opened in 1872. I doubt it. But it may have been. It's certainly not referred to in the scripture. But I find this intriguing that it was the very year that we feel the invisible return of the Lord, that the headstone returned invisibly to the pyramid and was marked there at the pyramid. Now we'll look at another place that Christ is shown in the pyramid, in the Grand Gallery. You can notice by the figures here of Dr. Edgar, and that's a drawing of Brother Edgar, how steep that is. And I tell you, my own walk, I didn't find it easy to walk up the Grand Gallery. Oh, it was nice to have a height. That was a relief. But it was not easy. And it was nice that along the side walls, like Brother Edgar's showing, you had handholds. And they're placed very conveniently apart to help you on your way up. And over each handhold, there are stones placed in the shape of a cross. Isn't that appropriate? That as we walk upward, as we walk the narrow way, as we enter the trials of our life, as we come to those places that are so difficult, how we need, how desperately, we need to resort to what Christ has done for us. Not just to the cross, but to the cross especially. We need to resort to his life, to his teachings, to the fact that when we err, my little children, see that you sin not. But if any man sin, we have a cross. We have an advocate with Christ the Father. You know, it's interesting that Jesus uses this symbol of the cross when he tells you and me what he expects of us. He said, if any man will be my disciple and follow me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Now, when Jesus said those words, Jesus had not yet died on the cross. The cross was there waiting for criminals. What did the disciples think he meant? Take up his cross. It was not a term that they could identify with, as you and I can identify. We can look at that, we can say, oh yes, he bore that cross to Calvary. That was something they couldn't say. But it had a meaning to them. Because usually, the cross, what was used for criminals, that was not its main use. Its main use was for martyrs. For those who believed in their cause enough, the wrong way, they fought, they made revolutions, they made wars, but they were willing to bear the end price, which they knew would be crucifixion. That takes on a special meaning when we see Jesus as the greatest martyr of all time. But even then, it meant a life of being willing to lose life to gain it. That was the main difference between the law and the gospel. Jesus said, it's been said that if you serve me, you'll be blessed and basket in store. He who loses his life but lost his life. But I say, he who loses his life for my sake will keep it. I'm introducing a new concept. A concept of sacrifice. A concept of a walk of the cross. And as you walk, the crosses are there. It's there for him to carry you. And we all know the story of the footsteps in the sand, where you will see two sets of footsteps, and all of a sudden the hardest place was just one. And he asked the Lord, why is there only one? And he said, that, my son, is when I carry you. When he carries us, not only his cross, but he carries us on the cross with him. While we're in the Grand Gallery, we're going to depart just briefly from our subject to notice another factor. You notice how the Grand Gallery walls are wider than the floor plan, and then they narrow in. And they eventually narrow in at the height to the same width as they are here. We like to notice that shape. And we like to notice that shape appears two places in the pyramid. And we like to notice the difference and the similarity between the two places. Here we see it in the Grand Gallery. There are, I believe, eight. I think it was eight overlappings. And you come down to 41.2 inches. That happens to be the same as this distance here. 41.2 inches. I learned from David, he said two pyramid cubits. So that is an easier way to think of it. Two cubits. There or here. But that shape appears someplace else. It's different, but it's similar. Let's look at the other place the shape appears. In the Queen's Chamber of the pyramid, there is a non-passage. It almost looks like a trial passage. It's rough finish. It's not smooth wall at the end of it. They call it the niche. And the niche, this is wrong figure, by the way. Just stop this figure here totally. That's a mistake. But the niche has five overlappings, and you come down to one pyramid cubit at the top. Am I right on that, David? What I talked to you yesterday? Is that one rail cubit? One rail cubit. One rail cubit. 21.7 inches, I think it was. 20.6 inches, okay. That was the one I was not able to determine in my own measurement in the charts that I was asking David yesterday. 20.6 inches. So you've got five coming up to a different measurement. Really, it's about half of the measurement of the Grand Gallery. Here you have it in the Queen's Chamber, where we picture perfect human life going forever. So we see something similar between this niche in the Queen's Chamber and the road we must take to get to the King's Chamber. There's a similarity in shape. There's a difference in dimension. There's a difference in the number of overlappings. But the shape is similar. Something both mankind and the church must do is conform to the rules of God. That's obvious. Any salvation, excuse me a second, I'm going to just a sip of water here. Conformity to divine principle is the basis of all life at all times. That was the basis in the Garden of Eden. Obey and live. disobey and die. That was the principle of the law covenant. Obey and live. Disobey and die. That's true with us. We must learn to obey if we live, because if we don't, willfully, we'll die. And that's certainly true for mankind. The higher you go, the narrower it becomes. The more conformed. You must be poured into a mold. You must be forced into an image. You must knock off the rough edges of what you are, and you must become something else. But what you must become differs. The standards are higher for the church. You're going up 8 overlappings instead of 5. The requirements are different at the top. Here you've got 1 cubit, the measure of a perfect man. 1 perfect me. You must come into that measurement. But now let's go back to the King's Chamber, to the Grand Gallery, and say, what does the church conform to? The width at the top is exactly the dimension you need to get to the King's Chamber. It is precisely the height and the width of that last passage into the King's Chamber. We must be conformed to the divine standard, not conformed to an earthly standard. Actually, that's, you gotta do it that way. I can see the slides that they made reverse. The copper, you're entering in the copper. Oh, that's right, that's correct. There's something that isn't right here. Well, I can't figure out what's wrong, but the look on it, I said there's something out of perspective on this. But in any case, you've got this height that's right here. What? Oh, okay, that's, we're looking for the opposite direction. Thank you. So we're looking basically at a similarity, of two measurements that bring to the same place. What we're conformed to what we need to enter into the kingdom. Now the last thing we want to look at is something that has recently been proposed by a brother in Chicago, Brother Robert Crane. And, if I can explain it, I will try to explain this. It's a place. Have you heard? Brother Robert suggested, he loves pyramid studies, and he has gotten quite a few of these. He said, if you were to etch a cross on the surface of the pyramid, he noticed a very interesting thing. He said, he chose this for the crossbar because it was exactly 3,600 pyramid cubits, which times 40 gives you 144,000. He said, the church under trial gives you the cross of the church. If the church 40 is the period of test of trial. Then he said, now if I'm going to take this and try to figure out where the base of this cross would be, what would I use? He said, there's one angle the pyramid always uses. Every pyramid passage is built on an angle. So he postulated that, and he comes down 21 degrees, the angle of the pyramid passages, and the cross is precisely at the level of the King's Chamber. At the 50th level of a masonry. So he said, our cross is based upon this. It connects our present experiences to the headstone. Because if you go and take the outer angle, you come, of course, to the headstone. That we can etch a cross on there showing that the church's cross is connected with the cross of Christ. That from, to be in the King's Chamber, we need to bear a cross that connects us totally to the headstone of Christ. We need to conform to His image. His image is the final degree. So we've looked at really 7 places where the church is shown, where Christ is shown. We've seen Christ shown first in the grotto. The place that was naturally there, the center of the whole thing, the foundation of the pyramid. We've seen Christ shown in his birth at Bethlehem by the pyramid angle going through Bethlehem. We've seen Christ third in the 286.1 measurement, east to imperfection, and back west in the coffer to perfection. And up in explosion to providing life. We saw that again in the top stone. How the top stone would have represented Christ in a complete perfect model of the pyramid. Rejected by men, but perfectly fit for his plan. We saw the cross again, Christ again, in the missing top stone. In the poles that were erected. We see Christ again, perhaps on the surface of the pyramid in the cross. There are six. I thought I had seven, but there are six that are down. The seventh thing we noted was what we must do to conform to Christ. The conformity into his image in the ceiling level of the grand gallery. It's only a picture, but it's all a picture. It fits beautifully so many of the principles, and certainly Christ must be the center of our life, even as Christ is the center, symbolically, of the pyramid.